Osiris.
Hi, I'm Richard Z. Rastafarian from Fear of a Craft Beer Planet, a podcast that talks a lot about the parallels between the beer industry and the music business. But really, we talk about whatever we want. The show is made up of four of us. Me, Richard the Rastafarian, the radio guy, Jay Rose, Ryan Egan, and Rob Forzik. They're the beer guys. They're the ones that teach me about craft beer, and I'm the one that gets the show on the air. You can find us on all social media platforms at Fear of a Craft Beer Planet.
I'm Bob Crawford.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Bob, where's the road taking you this week?
Well, you know, tomorrow will be Saturday, and my wife Melanie and I are hiking 13 miles for Cure Search, which is an organization that funds pediatric cancer research. So we have raised, thanks to many of the listeners of this podcast and friends and family and more and Avett Brothers fans and just a lot of really beautiful, generous, kind people, we've raised over $2,500.
Wow, that's awesome, man.
And Melanie and I, our goals, I think each of us was a $500 goal each.
That's incredible.
So we are, I want to thank everybody out there who's donated, and I will do my best to not pass out tomorrow and complete this hike and fulfill my end of the bargain.
That is awesome. 13 miles, man. That's like, that's almost $200 a mile. That's all you got to think, man. You got to make it those last ones. Those are
gotta hustle. Hustling. So, but really, you know, a lot, everybody's, I just know from my personal life, a lot of people are struggling right now and they're in need. And if you just quantify that by everyone out there, everyone knows someone who needs help in some way. And there's so many places that you can give your money. And I'm sure all of you out there give in many different directions. But I just want to thank you guys for supporting pediatric cancer research.
It's amazing. You and your wife are incredible, Bob. Speaking of other incredible people, but in different ways. Wait, that was a terrible transition. Because I really, I really meant you guys are awesome. Like, anyway, you know what's awesome? Totino's pizza wraps. Like,
no. If Totino's was our sponsor, it would be awesome.
Yeah. Anyway. So this week's episode is it's part two. Actually, part three of the Wolf Trap series. Part two went out last week on Patreon. Our conversation about your new project, which is really exciting and stressful and all the things that grad school are, but that I'm excited about. And we'll be catching up again, I think, to talk about that as you go on. But this week, the third and final installment in the Wolf Trap series, we have Pete Souza.
Ben, this was what I call a target of opportunity. Pete Souza, White House photographer during the Barack Obama administration, is friends with Cracker Farm. The photographer who works so closely and has for since 2005 with the Avett Brothers, the band that I play with. So Pete and Cracker Farm made friends, and Cracker Farm would always be like, "Hey, if you want to go to the White House, Pete Souza said he'll give you guys a tour and all this kind of great stuff." Well, fast forward a few years, and Cracker couldn't be there this weekend for the shows at Wolf Trap, but he got Pete Souza on the guest list, and I'm walking in. I just get to the venue. I'm walking off the bus, and I see this guy standing, off to the side in the parking lot, and he's got these cameras, and I think, that's Pete Souza. So I just walk right up to him. He was waiting to meet Dane to be brought in.
He came to meet Dane, probably.
Yeah, everybody does. So, but I saw, I was like, "Hey, are you Pete?" And he's like, "Yeah." He's like, "Oh, you're Bob," you know. So we started talking. I was like, "Hey, can I interview you?" I mean, I just, no setup, no research, no formal ask in the days and weeks prior. "Hey, can I, if we have a minute, can I pull you aside to ask you a few questions?" He was like, "Absolutely. I would love to do it." So, you know, all I really knew about Pete was he was Barack Obama's photographer. He took that amazing, incredible picture of in the Situation Room during the Bin Laden raid, and that iconic photo. and that he had a recent book out called Shade, which that you know he's been using his art and his work with the former president as a form of protest against the current president, and he put out a book called Shade that is based on his Instagram account and some of the things that he's been doing over the past couple of years since the Trump administration came to power. So we did sound check and he took some pictures and we ate dinner, and then I said, like, hey, are you available? And I thought maybe 15 minutes, but as we began to talk and I began to realize this guy was there for every minute of the Obama administration. He was a fly on the wall, and Pete, we spoke. He and I spoke for about 40 minutes. So here is the conversation.
Yes, incredible. Pete Souza, interviewed by the ever-hustling Bob Crawford.
Pete Souza, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Pete, you were President Obama's photographer for 8 years. So many questions, but I think I need to start with this one. How did you get to know President Obama and become the photographer for his presidency?
I mean, it's funny the turns that you take in life and where they lead. I happened to take a job in 1998 with the Chicago Tribune, based in D.C. as their national international photographer. And then in 2004, a state senator named Barack Obama was elected to the U.S. Senate. And we decided to do sort of a documentary look at his first year in the Senate. He was trying to keep a low profile, but because we were kind of the hometown newspaper, he gave me incredible access. And through that, I got to know him. Just, you know, it was a professional relationship. I was a journalist, but I was in his space a lot. And so he got to know me. And, you know, 4 years later, he was elected to the presidency and asked me to become his chief White House photographer.
Is that one of those opportunities where there's no, I need to think about this? Is it something that you just jumped at, or was there a little consternation for you?
There really wasn't any consternation for me. I knew that I was being considered and had kind of already made up my mind that as long as he understood that I really wanted to document his presidency for history, meaning I needed to have access to everything, as long as that was part of the deal, then I knew I was going to do this.
Were there any restrictions? I mean, I know in the Bush administration, the W. Bush administration, the communications department and the administration got a little bit of pushback for really manufacturing a lot of videos. And the Obama administration kind of did that. You know, I think presidencies, Republican or Democrat, they begin something and the next administration kind of picks up the ball in a lot of ways on a lot of things. What was it like for you as far as those restrictions, or were there canned things that you were like, this is a little staged for me?
Yeah, so I tried to keep it that my job was to document the presidency for history. And that was sort of my outlook on everything every day. That was the most important part of my job. That was my primary function. The communications office would, of course, use some of my photographs to put on the White House website, on a Flickr photo stream, later on Instagram when Instagram was invented. But I never lost sight of the fact that my job is to document for history. And I made that very clear to the communications office, that don't tell me what to shoot. I'm going to shoot things for history. And if you want to use pictures, as I said, for these social media tools, that's fine. But I'm going to do things the way they're supposed to be done.
What was it like as you, as his administration began and you began to work day by day? Did you guys have a rapport that was congenial? Like, Was there a lot of jokes and fun, or was it a situation where to keep that purity of the moment, you were always there doing your job, but no one, it was like you weren't there?
It was kind of a little of both. I mean, I think when somebody says to you, especially a young politician like Barack Obama, says, yeah, you can have access to everything. But then you have this guy every day following you around, taking pictures. It takes a little getting used to. So I was very cognizant of that. And I sort of like tried to give him space when I felt he needed space. And it's just it's a matter of intuition and feeling things out on, you know, what's the right amount of time to be in his space. And then after over a period of time, it was like, whatever, you know, he didn't really care if I was around ever. I was always there. There would be some days where I wouldn't say anything to him. I might say good morning, and at the end of the day, have a good night or whatever. Then there are other days though where I would converse with him. At least the way I did the job, the White House photographer is sort of the one person that is there for all these different compartments of his life, whether it be the tense meeting in the Situation Room, or playing with his kids in the snow, or dealing with domestic policy, or interacting with his wife. And people on staff would actually come to me and for a gut check, how's he doing today? And I would know. He had a really bad meeting, you know, last hour, just FYI, that, you know, if they were to ask me. Or I would say, hey, I think he's got like a sinus infection, so he's not feeling so good today. I could alert, you know, people on staff, and I think they appreciated that. People would come to me and ask me.
So what kind of a clearance? So you must have had full security clearance.
Well, I mean, I like to tell people that I had a higher clearance than Jared Kushner, you know. So I had one.
Meaning that your clearance process went through legitimately and smoothly.
Very smoothly, yeah. No. So I had what's called top secret SCI, which is the highest level. And that enabled me to be in the room when they were talking about this, you know, classified information. Now, there's a lot of stuff that I wasn't privy to because a lot of classified information is actually in writing. And I did not get memos, you know.
And he read.
That he read. And so I was not privy to those. Now, I would hear them talking about those memos and things like that. But it wasn't as if, you know, I was part of the team that got those, you know, really classified briefings.
Did you get to the point where you would be in the room and there would be a high-level meeting and maybe in the Situation Room or something where you were just into your zone, doing your thing, and whatever they were saying, you just weren't even really focused on? Or were you always just so conscious of what was going on?
I was trying to be focused, at least generally, obviously, what the topic of conversation was. But then also, if there was tension in the room, trying to feel that, because that, I think, would help me in terms of photographing the moment and knowing who in any particular meeting the tension was with. If there was, you know, if there was a kind of an angst between the president and somebody else, I wanted to try to accurately capture that mood and that emotion. So I mean, I couldn't recount conversations to you, but I could tell you generally, you know, what the feeling was in any given meeting.
Are there pictures that we'll never see because they were too personal?
Probably not. The way the Presidential Records Act works, like every single picture that I ever took during the 8 years, 1.9 million, are now all at the National Archives. And in due time, all of those will be available for everybody to see. You know, there's like a period of time, like I don't want to use the word embargo, but there's like a 5 or 8 year period of time before they're all released. Now, the ones with his family from non-official events, he can decide to hold those back a little longer. So those would be the ones that possibly people wouldn't see for a while. But anything that involves an official event is any meeting that he ever had or any, you know, presidential event, all those pictures will be made available.
So as far as photographing in the residence, how often did you do that? How often were you there? And how did it work? Did he say, hey, I'd like you to come up and hang out and just get some photos of the family? Or was that, how was that worked into the schedule?
So, well, first he had an office in the residence. So I'd sometimes go up to his office in the residence where he worked every night.
Well, how did that work? Like where, maybe first give us like what an average day, if there was an average day, what would that be like?
Yeah, there's no real average day, but generally on a day that he wasn't traveling, he would come to the office sometime between 9 and 10 in the morning. He was kind of a late starter. And then he would be in the office until sometime between usually 7 and 7:30, go have dinner with his family. If there wasn't a function that night, or if he didn't have to come back to the Oval Office that night, he would then go to the Treaty Room, which was an office that he had in the private residence. And he would work there every night from like 8:30 until 1, 2 in the morning. He stayed up late. I think he felt he got a lot of work done at night by himself. He would read 10 letters that were chosen for him from his correspondence office. He had a briefing book that the staff would put together for the next day's meetings, bios on everybody that he was meeting with, all kinds of things like that. So he actually did a lot of work. He made phone calls. The times that I would go up there, he would sometimes have a ball game on in the background with the sound turned down, you know, so it'd sort of be multitasking, if you will. And the times that I would go up there would be if anybody from the staff was going to go meet with him, I would go up with them. If there was something, you know, big in the world going on and I knew he was going to be working on something, or calling ahead of state or things like that, and I would just usually just check with him directly, and he would say, yeah, that's fine, just, you know, let the usher's office know you're coming up or whatever. And then in terms of like family events, it was there's no rules per se. I mean, I would hear about things and I would ask either him or Michelle's chief of staff, hey, see if they want me to, you know, take pictures at this. Or there were times that they would come to me and tell me things I didn't know were going on, family functions, and ask me to be there for that. So just kind of, it was very organic, I guess.
What was it like to kind of eavesdrop or, you know, be the fly on the wall for their private family time?
Well, you know, Michelle has a really good sense of humor. Well, he does too. But it was fun. It was fun that she would like to make fun of some of his idiosyncrasies. And I of course thought it was very amusing.
You're saying that a wife was giving her husband a hard time.
Yeah. And in a fun kind of way. And I think she appreciated that I would, you know, she could see me chuckling.
She had an audience.
And I don't think he was always happy that I was chuckling at his expense. But you know, it was as normal a marriage and family life as one could have, given the circumstances of, you know, the situation that they were in.
Hey friends, you're listening to The Road to Now, which means that you like to listen and learn. Well, what if I told you there was a way that you could, when this episode wraps up, that you could just go to another place and not just get a podcast, but get books that would do it the same way? Ladies and gentlemen, one of our sponsors, Libro.fm, is an audiobook company that lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your local bookstore. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers, recommendations for booksellers around the country, and we've even got a Road to Now playlist there, so you can find books by our previous guests, including Jefferson Cowie, Edward Baptist, so many great authors. I listen to books all the time on Libro, and I just love it. One of the things that I do is I love listening to novels, right, to fiction. I don't spend a lot of time reading fiction, but when you get a book written by one of the great authors, a lot of times they read them themselves and have other voices. So I listened to BJ Novick's One More Thing, which is one of my favorite pieces of fiction and short stories that I've read in forever. And I loved it so much, I got it so I could listen to BJ Novick read it. And it was like a whole new experience. So you can go to Libro.fm and you can use our promo code RTN. And with that, you'll get 3 months of audiobook membership for the price of 1 month, which means that for just $15, you'll get 3 months, one book a piece, and you'll get yourself a big book if you want to. You know, you can get a whole month out of something like a Grant biography or Washington biographies. So guys, if you love what we're doing and you love your local bookstore, please support us and go to Libro.fm. That's Libro.fm. Enter the promo code RTN. And join us there. We hope that you'll support them. As I said, I was a member of Libro before. We picked them up as a sponsor. I actually approached them myself and said, will you sponsor us? Because I love their model. So go check them out. You can go to Libro.fm or you can go to our episode page. There's links on every one of those. Check them out. Thank you guys for supporting us and enjoy this episode.
I have to ask you now about one of the most iconic images of the 21st century, one that will outlive us both and generations and generations to come. It is that shot in the Situation Room during the mission to kill Osama bin Laden. What can you tell us about that night and that moment?
Yeah, so I was alerted probably a week ahead that something was going down. I didn't know the specifics.
With bin Laden or just in general?
I didn't know it was involving bin Laden. I suspected it was, but I didn't know for sure. But I knew it was a special ops mission because John Brennan, who was then the Homeland Security Advisor, it was his assistant that said to me, don't go out of town next weekend, you know. And said that it's either going to be Saturday or Sunday. And when she told me that, I knew that it was a special ops mission because those were so dependent on weather. So I knew, I had in my mind, you know, kind of what it was. So it turned out to be on a Sunday. And he tried to keep to his normal Sunday routine, which was he went and played golf in the morning, but he only played 9 holes, and everybody thought he only played 9 holes because it was raining out. Well, that's not why, because he needed to be back at the White House. But it was sort of a good cover. And so around 1 o'clock in the afternoon is when he had the first meeting in the Situation Room, and as they started discussing what was about to unfold, I was like, holy shit, this is going to be a historic day. And it wasn't until 3 hours later, this is around 4 o'clock DC time, is when the raid actually took place. And they all gathered in this tiny room across from the Situation Room where the communications link had been set up so that they could monitor the raid in real time. The thing that was unusual was usually when all the national security officials would be in a room like that, there would be discussion back and forth the entire time. And for 40 minutes, you had the most powerful people in the executive branch of our government essentially speechless because all they could do was watch what was unfolding. And they were really powerless to affect what was happening in any way. I mean, their decision to launch this raid had already been made in the days and weeks before. Now it was just up to those guys on the ground, those Navy SEALs. And I think when you see that photo, you feel their tension because that's what it was like for 40 minutes.
What was happening that moment, that photo that we all see, what was happening at that moment?
So as best I can determine, it was during the last 8 minutes of the raid. I mean, one of the great things about digital cameras is there's a timestamp. And so I know about when the picture was taken. The reason I say about, because cameras lose, you know, my camera may not have been 100% accurate on the time, but I was probably within a minute of actual time. But it was definitely during the last like 8 minutes of the raid. So my suspicion is it was a time when the team was inside the house, the compound, and there was no visual on them. And so the national security team, including the president, were waiting for them to emerge, is the best I can guess. It's not definite, but I'm pretty sure that's when that picture was taken.
Are there other photos that you took that you feel like, well, everyone's going to be talking about this one forever, but I feel like this one is equally important and iconic?
So back up a little bit. See, there after the raid, there was another series of meetings because they were trying to determine, did they really get bin Laden? How did they know for sure? Did they need to do DNA samples? When do we announce this to the public? Those kinds of things. And so it wasn't until almost midnight, so 7 hours, more than 7 hours after the raid, 7 and a half, that he announced.
So did you see bin Laden on the screen? I mean, did you see what was going down on the screen while you were taking pictures, or were you always looking at those who were watching the screen?
Yeah, no, I was watching the people on the screen. I mean, they did eventually fax a picture of you know, bin Laden's body, and it was passed around in the Situation Room, which, you know, I caught a glimpse of that. I didn't see much. I was focused on the faces because I thought that was the most powerful part of what I was witnessing.
Are there other iconic photos that you, or photos that yeah, you feel like in your heart, you're like, man, this is the best one I ever took, or this one means so much to me?
On that particular day, I mean, I shot more than a thousand photos that day. And while they were in that little room during the 40 minutes of the actual raid, I shot, I think it was 102. The next day, the communications team came to me and said, we want to release some photos. And so I went and did an edit and ended up choosing seven from throughout the day, including one that, you know, has now become somewhat famous. But it was hard to choose because I think I had like six or seven from inside that little room when they were actually, watching the raid unfold. And it's very subtle differences between the images. And you just, you know, as a photo editor now, you're just trying to pick the one that really, you know, emotionally conveys what was taking place. I mean, the great thing about, you know, we were talking about the archive before, is in due time, people will be able to see all the pictures that I shot that day. And so I'll be curious to see if people think that I chose the right photograph. I think I really, even to this day, I think I chose the right one that best represents, you know, what happened in that room. There's very subtle differences between them, but I think I chose the right frame. But it'll be interesting to see what people think. And
was there ever a time the communication team was like, send us seven photos, and you sent them there like, well, what else you got?
They really trusted me. I mean, one of the things that I didn't want them to do, meaning the communications team, is look over my shoulder while I was editing, right? I wanted to be able to choose either myself or a photo editor that worked with me, choose the best photographs. We're the experts. Choose what we feel is the best photographs and then present those to the communications team. If they then decide they did not want to make it public, that so be it. That's fine with me. But I didn't want them, like, you know, saying, okay, we want to look at all your pictures and decide which one to make public. That's not the way I wanted things to go down, and we didn't do it that way. The people ask me, oh, what's your favorite photograph, or something like that. And to me, it was always about, creating the best body of work and not relying on one picture that say this is the most powerful picture. I mean, you're a musician. You probably don't want to say what your favorite song is because, you know, there's such a catalog of songs that the Abbott Brothers have that, you know.
It doesn't exist. It really doesn't exist. You could say I'm enjoying this song now recently, but yeah, it always changes.
And, you know, and you want to say what I used to say during the administration, I would say, well, it'll be the picture I make tomorrow. You know, that's sort of like what keeps you going, the next song that you write. But, I mean, another picture that's gotten a lot of attention, it's a picture of a young 5-year-old African-American kid just after he's told the president that his friends had told him that his haircut was just like his. And the picture shows Barack Obama leaning over, and he had just told this young kid, Jacob, go ahead and touch my head and see if it feels like yours. And so you see this, you know, young 5-year-old African-American kid touching the head of the president of the United States who looks like him. And I think that resonated with especially the African-American community in a way that probably no other image did.
What was it like election night 2016?
So election night 2016, the plan was for me, I went home and had dinner with my wife, and I was going to come back to the White House around 10. And I was going to go up to his private office in the residence that I had mentioned earlier because he had said he was going to call, you know, Hillary when it was announced. When the results came in, and around 10 or 11, I get this email, and he goes, "I'm not going to call anybody tonight."
From the president.
The president had emailed the chief of staff, who had forwarded me the email, I think, if my memory serves me correctly, and so I didn't go in. And I stayed up for a while watching the results on TV, and I was like, this is not good. And it looked like Hillary was going to lose. I wasn't sure, but I went to bed. And I woke up the next morning, early the next morning, like around 6 or 6:30. And I always had my BlackBerry and my iPhone right on my night table.
Which I'm sure your wife loved.
And I had I noticed on my iPhone, I had like 12 text messages from Brandi Carlile. And Brandi had stayed up all night because she was in London. So it was, you know, much earlier there. And she was just like beside herself. And that's how I learned that, you know, Donald Trump officially had won the presidency. And I went into the White House, and I lived through Watergate. I lived through the Kennedy assassination. We've had some terrible things happen in our country, and we've survived. So, you know, my attitude was, you know what? Shit happens, and I still can't believe it, but this is what it is. But there's a lot of young people that work in the White House who did not experience the same kind of things I have in my life. That's one of the advantages, I think, of being a seasoned guy in that job. And there's a young gal that was the assistant to the chief speechwriter, and her office was right across from mine, so in the West Wing. And she and I had become good friends. And I remember sticking my head in her office that morning, the day after the election, and I was like, "You doing okay?" It's all I said to her, and she just started bawling. And I mean, I was hugging her, had her mascara was running down my suit coat, and that was sort of the was happening throughout the West Wing that morning. It was a very depressing time.
Well, then let's talk about your books.
Yeah.
So first, in 2017, you put out a coffee table book why don't you describe it?
Yeah. So I wanted to produce a coffee table book of his 8 years in office using my photographs, which is was a challenge in that, you know, I had a lot of photographs, and you know, if you're doing a photography book, you know you want to only have a certain number. So we were thinking around 300, and it was really hard because so much happened during the administration. So I tried to sort of weave in the aesthetic pictures that show what the presidency is like, the historic pictures that show the most important things that happened in his presidency, but also show the what I call the little moments that to me tell you so much about him as a human being. And it was just a matter of trying to weave those all together in a very coherent way, and I ended up doing it chronologically because I thought that would be the best way to, you know, to see how the 8 years unfolded, to see the family come in every once in a while, and you know over the course of the book you see the girls grow up, so that's what that book was about.
So not uncommon. Other presidential photographers have put out books like that. I feel like they're important for our historical record. But you put out a second book a year later called Shade. So tell us about that.
Throughout the time that I was producing the coffee table book in 2017, I started my personal Instagram account where I started throwing shade on Instagram, but it was very subtle because I didn't necessarily say in my commentary what I was referring to. But it was, but I was always referring to something that Trump was doing, or a tweet that Trump had sent out, and I would post a picture of President Obama, and then with a snarky or humorous or biting commentary, and people really caught on. Even when I was doing like the publicity for the coffee table book, everybody wanted to ask me what I was doing on Instagram, and I wouldn't talk about it. I would just say my Instagram feed speaks for itself. That's all I would say. Then something happened where I thought Trump had really crossed the line. I think it was when he accused President Obama of a crime, of basically Obama ordering, according to Trump, ordering a wiretap on Donald Trump, which was like the most ridiculous thing. You know, you accuse your predecessor of a felony, basically. When that happened, I had a change of heart, and I called my book agent the next day and I said, I want to do a shade book, and I know exactly how we're going to format it. I'm going to use Donald Trump's tweets on one page, and on the other page I'm going to like basically do what I'm doing on Instagram. And that became the genesis of that book.
It's like a call and response.
Call and response. Because look, here's the thing, is I want people, especially young people, to know what's happening now is not normal. This is not how a president should behave. The president of the United States should not call the press the enemy of the people. You should not use the term fake news when there's a story that he doesn't particularly like. He shouldn't be able to lie to the American people, like, you know, multiple times every day, and say it enough times, say these lies enough times that people start believing it. Because, you know, if you repeat something 10 times, you start to think it's true. And it's important for people to realize that this is not normal. This is not how a president should behave. And I thought I had this sort of unique perspective, both visually and then with my commentary, to be able to respond to this. And so that's sort of like kind of what I've done, and I'm continuing to do on Instagram even this morning. I posted something.
What was it like the day that after the 2 days after the election when Trump came to the White House? What was that? Just what was that like when the when Obama and Trump were sitting there side by side, and we suspect at some point Obama told Trump to not hire Michael Flynn and that North Korea was going to be his biggest challenge as president. What was that like? What did you hear?
Well, it's not so much what I heard, but what I saw, which was the surreal nature of, you know, this. I'm not sure how to refer to him. This con man, I guess. I did an interview with a Portuguese newspaper, and the Portuguese word for con man is vigarista. So I kind of like that, vigarista. So this vigarista, you know, showed up at the White House, and, you know, a guy that had gotten 3 million less votes than Hillary Clinton was going to be the president. And it was, I guess the interesting thing to me was watching President Obama try to take the high road and be accommodating to Donald Trump that day, 2 days after the election, when, you know, I'm sure he had a lot of feelings that weren't necessarily positive about the man that he was meeting with. But at the same time, you know, we have an electoral college, and however, you know, the Russians helped mislead the American people, and the fact is, you know, Trump got more electoral college votes than Hillary Clinton, and thus was, you know, are going to be our next president. And I think, what's Barack Obama going to say about that? I mean, so he tried to take the high road, and I know that was, you know, one of the more difficult things he had to do in his presidency, I guess, is what I'd say.
Have you seen President Obama since he left office?
Yeah, I see him every once in a while. I communicate with him online more than I see him in person. I'll see him, I might see him next week, but I'll definitely see him in July at his, he has a birthday get together with a bunch of his guy friends, and so I'll see him then. Yeah, so I see him every once in a while.
I mean, so we're here backstage at Wolf Trap outside of Virginia. Pete's here for the Avett Brothers concert tonight. He's taking took some pictures today. I know Pete through Cracker Farm. All our listeners know Cracker Farm. So I guess it would be like if I didn't see Cracker Farm in a long time. It's funny, you were talking about being that fly on the wall for his presidency and kind of just trying to not be noticed as a photographer. Well, Cracker Farm, we've been with him for so long. I mean, 2005, I think. And it's, I can't, he's never a fly on the wall for us. You know, he's just, he's one of the band in so many ways. How did you meet Mike?
Yeah, so I mean, I started following different bands on Instagram. And the Avett Brothers were was one of the bands that I was following, and you know, it's really interesting to me to see how some of the bands' Instagram feeds have evolved, and of course, because I was following their account, I started seeing this, you know, Cracker Farm as the photographer, and I was like, Cracker Farm, who the heck is that? And so, like, I just figured out who he was, and I saw that you guys had a show at, I think it might have been at the Patriot Center, or what's, I don't know what it's called now.
George Mason University.
Yeah. And I just emailed him out of the blue. I was like, hey, I see you guys have a show. Do you want to, like, I'd love to meet you. Do you want to come by the White House? And he was like so like surprised that I had reached out to him, but you know, I really appreciate the work that he's doing with the band, and that's how I met him. And it was just, you know, sort of me reaching out to him, and he came, and I gave him a tour of the White House, and sort of have kept in touch with him the last few years, and have, you know, he keeps telling me to, you know, come out to a show if you want to come out to a show. And, it, you know, just the way my schedule was, it just never worked out. And then, you know, I saw you guys had three shows here. I'm going to be out of town tomorrow and Saturday, but I said, hey, I'd love to go Thursday. And that's, you know, so I reached out to him again, and I'm kind of disappointed he's not here though.
Yeah, me too. I wanted to see you guys together. Like, I would like him on the couch next to you. Yeah. Like, because I just make funny looks at him, and we just make each other laugh while we're asking questions. And I think it'd be interesting for him to ask you questions.
Yeah.
So, but I...
He came to... I did a talk in Nashville, which is where he lives. And so I did a big presentation on my book tour, and my Shade book tour. And so he and his wife came. So that was nice to spend a little bit of time with him.
Well, we're so glad that you connected with him, and you're now connected with us. And you're, of course, connected with Brandy Carlisle, a good friend of ours. And Pete, thank you for taking the time to sit down with me today. It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob. I really appreciate it. That was fun.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now was hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer. And today's music, like pretty much always, is by the wonderful Paul DeFiglia. As always, also, we'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, Peggy Donica, and the newest one, Susan Sharp. If you'd like to support us and what we do, you can do that on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. We're working on some pretty cool stuff over there, so I'm excited to share that with y'all. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second and does a lot to help us spread the word. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Take care. Osiris.